Awesome to welcome back Greg Tonegal to the Basketball Podcast. Tonegal stands as one of the most accomplished coaches in college basketball history, leading Indiana Wesleyan to three NAIA national championships while becoming the winningest coach in program history with over 500 career wins. He is the youngest coach across NCAA and NAIA basketball to reach 500 victories, pairing elite competitive success with sustained national dominance. We're also very fortunate that Coach Tonegal has created his all-access coaching video series, which is available at gregtonegalbasketball.com and immersionvideos.com, offering an inside look into championship-level program building, including all access to a coaches meeting, a player film session, in-game coaching sessions, and practice footage. Hey, Coach, brief interruption from your podcast to hear from one of our top supporters, Hoopsalytics. Is your starting lineup not performing to your expectations? What if your star player is injured? Who should you play together instead? You can answer questions like this using the powerful Hoopsalytic basketball platform to reveal your most productive players and lineups. Just ask the AI assistant, and based on extensive player and lineup stats and analytics, you'll get accurate, data-driven answers instantly. You can literally ask anything about teams and players and then start making even better strategic decisions. Hoopsalytics also provides top-tier video link stats with a 12-hour turnaround time, as well as handy visualizations, interactive shot charts, coaching stats, easy-to-create film sessions, and lots more. And unlike the alternatives, you get unlimited video storage with no hidden fees. Best of all, Hoopsalytics is more affordable. Now in year seven, Hoopsalytics is a true game changer for thousands of basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball and start using advanced stats and AI to win more games today. Coach Tonegal, welcome back to the Basketball Podcast.
Excited to be back. It's been a little while.
You're a fan favorite. We had to have you back, and such a fan favorite that we had to help create a video series to share more of the inside look. Tell us a little bit about that series and how it represented you and your program.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun doing that series. It's really just a raw, authentic behind the scenes. After we made it, I thought maybe I should have went back and scripted it a little bit more because it caught me saying just off the cuff remarks about our team, about where we're at in practice. And in the games, I totally forgot I was mic'd up, and which is a good thing, right? I think we wanted it to be just like, what's happening? The good and the bad. Watch some of it. I'm like, man, that's how I sound or that's how I look. But at the same time, this is the real life that we as coaches live and work in, right? There's a lot of challenges. Things aren't always good as they seem. You look from the outside and you think, man, that must have been an easy season. You guys won 28 games or whatever. You've coached long enough. It was anything but easy, but that's why we love it. We love the challenge and the every day is going to bring something new. And that was the hope, is just to allow coaches to be a fly on the wall in everything we are doing, from practices to games to player meetings to in between. So it was a lot of fun.
To my knowledge, absolutely unique. And we thank you on behalf of the coaching community for sharing that, because there's nothing like it out there in terms of just the authentic inside look. Again, not just the practice stuff. There's lots of that stuff, but the inside look, you shared your philosophy so openly on the first podcast, and then we got to see it in action. And I think that's what's beautiful about it. And coaches, you can go check that out, gregtonegalbasketball.com and immersionvideos.com. And coach, you mentioned 28 games. That's a heck of a year, but you also mentioned to me offline a little bit, that's not all it's made up to be sometimes. A little bit of struggles, obviously, along the way to 28.
That's interesting. I was talking to somebody the other day, and just at times it felt like we were 16 and 16, not whatever we were, 27 and 5 or 28 and 4. But that's coaching. There's a lot of challenges, and it's not all about winning. If it's all about that end line, there's only one person that's happy. We got knocked out in the Sweet 16, and it was an upset. And if everything goes to that final game, you can look back and say it's a disappointment. But as you and I were talking, each week that passes, it's like a little more healing for a coach. Like, you get further away from it, you broaden your perspective, and you start to think, man, what did I like about last year? What was good about last year? Where did I grow? I'm doing a lot of reflection right now and saying, okay, this was good, this wasn't good. Like, where do I need to go in this next phase of coaching? It's not just our players that need an offseason. Like, we need an offseason, and I'm excited about that. Every year I pick something and I really go down that path, and I'm excited to figure out what that is and then go hit it hard.
We're going to go into that a little bit through this podcast as well. I know one of the big things on your mind is this concept of habits. So maybe frame that first for the audience.
I think a lot of this started, I've always been just a creature of habit myself. Like, I have a routine that I stick to. Habits are easy for me, but I realize they're not always easy for other people. And habits have become a framework for how I tend to view coaching. And some of this has been growth and conversations along the way. I had a conversation with Ben McCollum 3 years ago, and it really impacted me as I listened to Ben. And I had a man crush on Ben before everybody else did. Okay, let me state that. I was following him in Division Two and was just blown away. And we were talking, and I wouldn't say he explicitly described it this way, but over the course of the conversation, I could just see how much of a believer he was in habits and how he could ingrain them into his athletes and his players at a better rate than all the rest of us could. And it made me double down and go look at things. And part of the reason I like that so much, I had just finished my doctorate, and it was part of my dissertation was on habits. So I was like really intrigued. And I think coaching so much comes down to habits. There's the psychology of habits, which a lot of us either don't understand or once we do, we get really excited about. But then for me, taking theology, meaning how are people, what's for the purpose of people? And you form those two things and you add that into skill development. I think you can develop people and you can motivate people. There's that old adage in the Navy SEALs where they talk about you don't rise to your level of training, but you fall to your habits. I think that applies to coaching. Players don't default to what they know or what they hear you saying all the time. They default to what they do 1,000 times over and over again. And so there needs to be this shift, I think, at least for me, rather than asking the question in frustration, why don't you understand? I'm asking, what are you repeatedly doing? Because, like I said, they're going to fall back on their habits. And so I'm often thinking about how do I ingrain these habits into my players, which is a fun, I think it's a fun way and it's a new perspective to look at coaching.
So maybe first, what's changed in terms of that? You've mentioned ingraining it in terms of your players. What is on your mind right now that maybe possibly has changed?
I think it's simplifying things for me. One of the best periods of growth for me as a coach is when I coached my own kids from sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. You get, if you're coaching AAU, you rarely get practices. You get limited time, but you realize games come down to just a few things, right? Possessions. So it's turnovers and it's offensive rebounds. Defensively, you can't be scheming up a lot of things because they're sixth, seventh graders. And so, like, how do I simplify winning habits into my players that can be repeated over and over again? And so I think in the last maybe even decade, our practices have become more simple and more based upon habits that we can repeat over and over again. And I really do think games come down to winning the simple little things often.
Can you give us an example? What do you mean by simplifying practice? And then what is something that you can repeat over and over again?
Yeah, so I'll give you like a practical example of something we did a lot this year. We were realizing like we were pretty good defensively on the perimeter. We weren't great in the paint according to Synergy. So Synergy spits out these stats and it's okay, what do you do with all this right now? And so we started just saying, man, we got to get better at forming walls. That part of it is they want to take the charge out of the game. So you can't take a charge anymore. So we started to talk about how do we use our chest and how do we wall up at the rim? And so instead of coming out right away in practice and maybe going 5-on-5, we just one-on-one walls where there'd be a collision at the rim. And you think that's pretty simple. It's hard to do. Some guys want to avoid the contact. Some guys want to turn. Some guys want to slap down on the ball. And we spent the whole year trying to perfect this wall and we got better at it. And we started to realize how many times a game, especially one or two possession games, are going to come down to you meeting chest to chest at the rim and being able to win a game. And that's something that we'll continue to do and break down and keep it real simple. There's no scheme involved in that. There's no thought process involved in that. The idea is like you have to ingrain in your player's mind, I believe that this game will be won if I stick my chest onto somebody in the middle of the paint. It's going to cost me some pain, but man, the cost to win is well worth it.
So I'd love to hear your thoughts. I actually talked about coaching youth in AAU. I was at practice last night talking about chesting the ball. And what I found is the hard habit is not the first contact, it's being able to maintain the contact or maintain the position. So can you give us some insights in terms of the technique or the teaching points that you use to help your players?
So if you even step back further, one of the, we would call them habits, would be hit first. We want to ingrain in our guys' mentality. We're going to hit first. So let's say if you're a perimeter player, the game's become very physical. As an offensive player, you watch these guys, they're like running backs going in, sticking shoulders into people. So as a defensive player, you've got to gain legal guarding position. So we work a lot on that. Like, how do you slide? But then how do you deliver the hit? Because if you just sit back, that offense is going to knock you back. And the offense is trained to do that. So we got to counter that. And so we'll spend a lot of time on the perimeter, hitting first with our chest. And there's always this gray area of what's legal and what's not. But the game has become so physical, I think referees are allowing us to get away with that. Then the second layer to that is what's going to happen at the rim. We haven't had a great shot blocker in a while, so we're not trying to block shots. We're just trying to chest. And one thing we've noticed is when we stat it, so we'll line up half the guys on the right elbow, we'll line up half the guys on the left elbow. The right elbow's got the ball, left elbow's just got to meet him at the rim. We shoot less than 30% on those finishes at the rim. They're 2-foot shots, but because you have a chest in your way, because a guy's walling up, it is so much harder than you think. And so we'll stat that and we'll show our guys. We'll just say, hey, we had 10 attempts at the rim and we only made three. That's pretty good defense. Where we let them off the hook is when we foul. So being disciplined with not coming down, resisting the urge to slap, just go up, trust that a 30% shot's going to be in our favor. And then we got to clean it up on the backside.
Such a great example of a habit and bringing a habit to life in your practices. What are some of the other daily habits that you've found, say, most predictive of on-court, say, trust or leading to minutes or different things like that for your players? Because that's ultimately what they want is the habit that leads to them playing.
I call them response habits, and we weren't great at this year. So I'm just, a lot of this comes out of things you failed in, right? So our team, as we learned our team, a bad call would just erupt us. Often, if there was a bad call, what we saw is our team spread apart. So the simple habit was, as soon as there's a bad call, you go touch that guy, you go grab that guy, there's got to be some physical touch. And in coaching, how often do we measure stuff that maybe doesn't turn the needle as much as we think? We stats have become just paralysis by analysis. But some things we don't stat are these intangibles. There's people that have done studies on the amount of touches, the amount of hand claps. Steve Nash was known for that in the NBA. So one of the responses was, what do we do after a bad call? We started to learn too, some of our guys just couldn't handle missed shots, it just hanging their heads. And so we started to, okay, if you miss a shot, man, that head cannot go down. You are sprinting back, right? Because a missed shot not only affects the offensive possession, but what's it doing on the other end with the defensive possession? So we started calling that a habit. What's your habit when you miss a shot? We had a guy who's he didn't get the ball, he just would stop playing. And we recognized that. And they're like, hey, if you don't get the ball, I understand you're frustrated, but what if you went and screened for the person who didn't get you the ball? Talk about counterintuitive. I know you're mad at that guy because he didn't post feed you. But what if instead you went and screened him? And so we worked on these things all year long because habits are hard to break. If I have a habit of hanging my head or being mad about not getting the ball, I'm not going to break it because my coach tells me to. There's a reason why it's a habit. It's a second nature. It is ingrained. And psychology tells us the only way to break a habit is to form a new habit. So you have to give your guys something to counter that with. So each of them had a counter habit that we would focus on. So rather than doing this, start doing this. And I think over time we grew. We never perfected it, but I think you're always going to be working on those things.
I love that. That's such a practical example. My psychology goes back way long time ago, and they called it thought stopping, which is essentially what you're saying. Bring something to consciousness so you can notice it, you can normalize it, and then you're taking a step further, which is obviously creating this response to it, which is the most important part. How are you going to respond to it? Can you give us some other examples of different habits that you've worked on in that way?
Yeah, so we had team habits, and I think everybody has team habits, whether they know it or not. And these are the things your culture over time, I think, teaches and ingrains and reinforces. So one thing we talk a lot about is create for a teammate. It's a mentality, but it's also a habit. Our players come into our program, and I think just basketball in general is what's in it for me. There's a real self-focus, and a lot of it's how they're trained and taught. They're going to go into an offseason, and they're going to be taught to only play when the ball's in their hands. Parents are paying a lot of money to have a trainer tell them what to do when the ball's in their hands. But the reality is the ball's only going to be in their hands a fraction of the time. So now we're dealing with players that have habits that only know how to play when the ball's in their hands. So we spend a lot of time teaching them to think about creating for others, because most of their ingrained habitual thought is, how do I create for myself? My dad told me to score. I'm only going to play if I score. I'm only going to get recognized if I score. And as coaches, we're like, no, that's not it at all. Like, how do we get that out of their mind? So rather than tell them, stop taking bad shots or stop playing selfishly, we tell them, create for a teammate. How do you create for a teammate? And my assistant coach runs the offense, and he just does a tremendous job of this. It's really about identity formation. Who are you on this team? What do you bring to this team? Because we don't need five scorers on the court. Like, in fact, we can't have five scorers on the court. We need guys that do different things. And so as you're teaching identity, you're really teaching roles. And no matter what your role is, it all comes back to creating for others. So if I'm a great shooter, I create others by giving great space. And that may be teaching somebody how to use the corners, when to cut, when to space. If I'm a great screener, I can create for others by screening. If I'm a great offensive rebounder, I get on the glass. And to me, what's one of the hardest part in coaching is to sell that and to get guys excited about that. Just like walling at the rim, right? You got to get to a point where a guy says, man, if I stick my chest on this guy, we'll win games. If I play my role and I create for others, we will win games. And once everybody really buys into that and that those become habits, our offense looks really good. And everybody's like, what are you running? So we're not running a lot of stuff. We're all creating for each other. It's a mentality, like we're tied in. And those are the habits every day you're working on. And I would say the number one, as we've talked about, is creating for others.
Love that, creating for others. Now let's go back to your youth coaching hat. What are you doing at that level in terms of creating for others? Because roles get defined the longer you play in the game. And at those ages, we want players to explore a little bit more and to see possibilities. But at the same time, we also know they're not all equal at that age. So talk to me a little bit, if you had your hat on, thinking about that.
I think that's harder when you get with those younger kids. So once again, I think you're doing less. You're trying to me, I like to eliminate the dribble. I just think the more kids pound it, the less they're able to do all these other things. And so we'll talk a lot about reversals. But if all you talk about reversals, sometimes you don't get in the paint. So there's this balance in coaching offense is like, how many times do we need to reverse it? How many times do we need to get in the paint? We know there's a correlation there. All the statistics tell us the more you reverse it, the more you get in the paint, the higher your points per possession end up in. So we're trying to teach those mentalities and those habits with kids. And when I coached youth, we probably had two plays. And other than that, it was like, can we teach you how to play? And once again, if your mentality is create for others, you'd be surprised how often it comes back. Now, you've heard the old adage, if you give it up, you often get it back. Nobody believes that until you try it. But once you try it on a fast break, if you give it up, you'd be surprised how many times it comes back. And so that mentality plays out in the half court too. When I set a screen for somebody, I often get open. Once again, I don't think they believe it, but that's coaching. Over time, you got to convince them that this wins games, and you try to get them to be willing to do that more times than not.
You've talked about it before, about being careful with what you reward. Can you connect that for us a little bit with these habits and then reward and different things that come with that?
I think it was Charles Duhigg wrote that book 2 decades ago called The Power of Habit. And it was something like every habit involves a cue, a behavior, and a reward. And you cannot forget the reward piece of that, because the reward reinforces whatever behavior was happening. So the cue is what triggers it. So every time a kid catches a ball, if he thinks about scoring, he's going to do that over and over. If his parents are in the stands cheering him on, then the reward is, hey, keep doing that. So the coach's job is to come in every time he sees that kid create for somebody, then the reward is, man, you recognize that. Hey, you just gave up a good shot and the team got a great shot. Or, man, you just created for your teammate. Nobody saw it, but the way you screened and the way you spaced, that made a big difference. And I think being intentional about when we watch video, now with talking with our college guys, can we reward the guys for the things that are not being recognized in social media, not being recognized for their parents? Like, those things have to be valued and brought to the top in a program. And if they are, like, if you consistently say, this is what we're about, this is what we're going to reward, what gets recognized gets repeated, right? That's it. That's in leadership. That's in life. So if we can recognize it more often, I think we'll subtly see that to begin to be repeated more often.
So it's a great time to be able to talk about that concept, because again, for me, it's like going to the point now of telling players, listen, none of the fans, your parents Often none of your teammates will notice that, but I will notice it, and we will notice it eventually, that you holding space in the corner, even though you didn't touch the ball, led to this advantage. And acknowledging that stuff so directly. So I'm on board with you with that. That's such a great point to be able to form these habits that we want. Now, of course, habits become challenged in performance. That's ultimately, we've got to transfer it from practice to performance. So talk to us about that process and how that process unfolds within your program.
Once again, in the moment of high pressure, you're going to default to your habits. You're not going to default to the thing you heard on the scouting report as much as we want. I think that's where a lot of frustration in coaches comes in, because I'll find myself saying, I told you this 3 times. But the problem is, in moments of the pressure, they're going to always default to their habits. And so I think it's crucial to find ways to practice under pressure, to create those environments in practice where music's loud, so you got noise. They're intentionally making bad calls. We did that a lot this year. We'd say, all right, we're just telling you right now, today we're going to make bad calls, because we'd lose our minds when we're in a game. If we're not doing it in practice, why is that? So we're trying to create that habit. But then I think you got to give them space to fail. Like, no matter how many times we say don't do something, if they do it and they fail, like, we got to give them space and say, okay, we're gonna let you try again. I'm not gonna let my frustration like quit on you, and you need to know that there's an opportunity to grow into this. It's just not gonna happen overnight. So creating those practice moments where the pressure's high, we can learn to fall back on our habits. Then over time, when the pressure in the game is equal to practice, we've already seen that and we've already experienced that.
Love that. Great example. Hey, coach, I'm excited to let you know that we just released a full 86-minute masterclass on how we developed youth players and teams in simple and easy to apply ways. These are the same methods that I used with local teams here in Los Angeles that have gone from getting beat by 30 to beating teams by 30. At Basketball Immersion, we coach kids for the long term, so they're still engaged, confident, and improving later in their basketball career, not just winning games at 8, 9, and 10. When you join, you get access to a youth coaching masterclass that's transforming programs around the world, plus our full library of incredible ready-to-use resources and courses. This masterclass alone is worth the investment, and your players will thank you. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sales today to get started. And the other thing that I find myself using a lot of your phrasing, you said culture isn't a slogan, it's a behavior shaping system. So I want you to go deeper with that and connect that a little bit for us with this habits conversation.
Yeah, culture's, it's one of those concepts. Everybody wants to talk about it. You look at every new hire in college basketball, and it's, we're gonna form a culture. And that's all great, but at the end of the day, I think you got to define what is it that we're trying to form. Is it a slogan? Because we all can put stuff on our walls. But how does it actually get ingrained into the heart and the minds of players? And for us, that's where I went back earlier. Coaching is, it's part psychology, it's part theology. I think it's a big part, because you're asking about purpose of human beings and who are they. And you've got to be able to get to the heart level, because all of our players act out of what's inside their heart, not just what's in their head. And that takes time, that takes relationship. We're in the off season right now, and I feel like almost every other day, guys are walking in and we're just having conversations. And I'm learning a lot about the season right now, more than I knew. Guys are really telling me what they were feeling, maybe where I could have done a better job. And it requires a lot of listening. I think my default sometimes is I just want to quickly give a response back. And that's not what they need right now. They need me to listen so I can actually hear what's inside their hearts and their minds. And then from there, I can begin to address the behavior, because behaviors are, they're always byproduct of something deeper. And too often, and I know I do this a lot, coaching is like behavior modification. I see a behavior, I just want to change the behavior. But that never sticks and that never lasts, as opposed to, okay, what produced that behavior? What's going on in your heart? How do I connect at a deep relational level? And once I do, then I got a chance to help you change those behaviors. And as you change those behaviors, going back to what we talk about, they become habits.
So for me, one of the things that I think is one of the hardest habits that you're trying to form is this concept of playing fearless basketball. To me, again, I do believe this after being in the youth space with elite players to new players. that one of the habits that if we can get there with them, they can be the best version of themselves. But so many players don't get there to play fearless basketball. So talk to us more about what you've learned since we last talked about this and how we can approach this as coaches.
And that, to me, this is the most fascinating thing to discuss. And it blows my mind, and I'm still learning. Let me ask you this, because I ask our players this. Who's the greatest shot blocker of all time?
Probably Bill Russell going back to that era, but again, hard to compare eras.
It depends on who you got in your locker room. I've heard Shaq, I've heard, now it's Wemby.
Wemby
But
for sure now.
the reality is this: fear is the greatest shot blocker of all time. Fear has caused more missed shots than any person. And most players aren't getting blocked by defenders. They're getting blocked by what's in their head, and that's fear. And I've begun to think about fearless as part of your program development. So when we think off season, we think, how do I make my players better ball handlers and shooters and defenders? And that's all important. But is helping your players become fearless a part of your overall development? Because if it truly is one of the greatest restrictors, then we got to get that out of the way, because it doesn't matter what you do in the off season. If come season, every time you miss a shot, you start to worry, or you're afraid of what others think, or you name it, fear's always going to get in the way. And here's something else too. I've thought a lot about. Psychologists say that as humans, we're only born with two fears: the fear of falling and the fear of loud noise. But yet there's over 500 phobias that are defined by psychologists say. So what does that mean? It means we learn fears. Throughout life, we learn fear. So then you got to begin to think, what fears do basketball players learn? We learn that if we fail, we'll be rejected. We learn that we might not be good enough for our dads. Like I see that a lot. Like we never reach their expectations. We fear letting our coaches down. And some of this is normal, but at the same time, if it grows and it really occupies the hearts and minds of our players, they're never going to reach their potential, because I believe this: fear is the thief of greatness. And all of us coaches want to be great. And to become great, you got to learn to overcome fear as an obstacle. So one of the questions I like to ask coaches and players is, do you want to reach your full potential? And everybody says, yes. Do you want to be great? Yes. Then you better overcome fear. And there's a lot of ways to go about this. I don't know how much time you have, but one of the ways, it's a framework for thinking about this. And I've talked to coaches about this before. It's the whole box versus line. And I believe you and I have talked about this before, but a lot of us think about player development and envision a box. So you've got a square, and what we do is we put our players either in or out of the box based upon their behaviors, based upon expectations. And what happens is it's very identity-based performance. So if they perform well, they're in the box. If they don't, they're out of the box. So they spend all their time trying to get in our box and our expectations as coaches. And what we do is we tend to judge players. And we label them early, we overreact with emotion, and we compare players. Like that's the default. And so you put them in this box, and you can get so far because our boxes that we form usually are, they have high expectations, but there's a limit. I remember 2013, we went to our fifth Elite Eight, fourth in a row, and I had a box. And if you fit in my box, man, I thought it was going to be good. And it was good until we kept hitting the ceiling, because these boxes form ceilings, they form borders, and they, as much as they keep people out, they also keep us in. And I was wanting to be great. I was wanting to go to that next level. And through talking to a mentor, through a lot of time in prayer, this word fearless kind of came to me. Hey, you've got to go to this next level. Your coaching has to become fearless. And I didn't really know what it meant at the time, but I began to explore it, and I began to really to grow in this area as a coach. And long story short is, we won three national championships in the next 5 years. And I don't think our strategy changed as much as just the mentality in which we started to pull fear out of the game. We started to recognize, okay, this is where fear exists in our program, and this is how I begin to take it out. And so instead of the box, what we now use is a line. So if you think about a line, it's all about trajectory and it's about movement. And so if you take a player, say you have a player who's not a great shooter. If you have a box mentality, it's he's either a shooter or a non-shooter. Like, how often do we label people as either or? As opposed to you see the line and you say, okay, he may not be where I want, but he's moving because this kid's in the gym every day. He's working out. He's moving the trajectory. He's moving across that line. And by placing him on the line, I allow him freedom to move forward. I haven't boxed him in. I'm not judging him. I'm not critiquing him. And so that the line becomes the score, but scorecard by which we measure and evaluate progress, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about progress and we're talking about growth. And in a lot of ways, we're taking fear out of the equation.
I'm just so fascinated by this. Let's start from the coaching perspective. What is a practical example of some fear that you've taken out of your coaching that has helped? And you mentioned obviously going to the ultimate level of national championship, but this is at all levels in terms of this. But what's something?
You can't take somebody to a place you haven't gone. So if I stand in front of my team and I'm like, we need to be fearless, but they sense the anxiety in me over our team's performance, which happens all the time, right? I've heard this from my players. Hey, coach, you're a little too tight right now. Big game on Saturday, Thursday and Friday. I'm like, I'm tight. I'm overcoaching. What happens for me in those moments is I overcoach and I underlead. I give the guys the 10 things they need to do. And if their heads are spinning and their heads are racing, instead of, look, if we do this one thing, we're going to win the game. And if you guys play fearless and you're free, because what I found out is fear and freedom can't occupy a player's mind at the same time. If there's fear, they're not playing in freedom. And when our teams aren't playing in freedom, we're just not playing at our full potential. So I think going into these big games and these big moments, I've learned to dumb things down. Once again, I'm going back to that being simple philosophy, like, because I don't want them thinking, man, come Saturday, I need them just full out, all in potential. Now, they need a few things that they need to understand. They just don't need 50 things. So our scouting reports went from 10 pages to here's 2 pages. It's simple. And the default button is just play hard. If you forget the 10 things that this other team does, remember who you are. Remember who we are becoming as a team. Remember that fearlessness means going after it. And let's go do that.
Love that. Can you give us an example of something? Like, can we help shape this in practice in some way? And can you give us an example?
Yeah, shot selection is a big one. I used to rate every shot. I remember my first couple of years, we'd sit down and there was like a numbering system. Was this a 1, 2, or 3? And we talked a lot about bad shots. The language we used was, that's a bad shot. That's a good shot. Every time a player got ready to shoot, guess what was in his mind? Is coach going to like this shot or is coach not going to like this shot? I don't think you can shoot a great percentage if that's in your mind when you're getting ready to shoot. So we started to eliminate that way we would talk. Now, being fearless isn't reckless. We're not jacking up shots. Once again, you have to replace it with a counter behavior. So the replacement is, are you creating for others? If this shot is the best shot our team can get, you're creating. Or maybe you should catch and create for others. And so that selfless mentality, that gets back to this I am third. We talk a lot about God first and others second. Self is often the number one thing that is bringing about fear. I'm protecting myself. I'm looking out for myself. And I think we're all fighting it on different levels about this, the selfishness of our culture. So we're trying to retrain that. Say, if you're thinking about others, if your identity is not in your performance, we think you can unleash a new level of fearlessness. So shot selection was a big one. It's the same thing on defense. Like, how often do we take guys out and they make one mistake? You pull them out, you yell at them. Now they're paralyzed because now they're thinking, if I make another mistake, I'm coming out. So I've got to allow guys to play through some of that while at the same time holding my expectations high. That is hard to do because early on I thought, if I lower my expectations, then I'm not going to be a good coach. I got to meet them where they're at, right? I need them to meet my expectations, but if they're not quite there, then I got to maybe lower my expectations and meet them in the middle somewhere. Although it feels like a compromise, the idea is that, are we in alignment? Are we working towards the same goal of becoming the best we can be? And I really do think that's true.
You referenced having these conversations with your players that have taught you a lot about what they were experiencing through the year. I feel like I've gone through that. In these AAU experiences, you're inevitably stuck in between games. You have all these informal conversations that lead to, I think, more sharing than normally would happen in, say, an office or something like that. And one of the things that came out from one of the players was they actually feel guilty shooting it too much. When they are arguably our best shooter and one of our best players. And that to me was such a fascinating thing. And you said these things are created. Do you have any advice for a scenario like that?
Yeah, that's a great one. In fact, I've run into that. And my response is, when we define selfish, it's putting yourself at the center. And so if you think about it, if I'm not shooting and I'm not creating space, in some ways that is selfish. You're flipping it upside down, right? You're saying by not shooting, you're withholding your gift from this team. And I need you to understand how you are built, how you're wired, the gifts you bring to this team. That is shooting. And we've had that conversation with guys. If you don't shoot it when you're open, I view that as a selfish act because what is happening is you're so focused on self. You're thinking about what if I miss? And so, like defining fearless for them, one way I've looked at it is it's the courage to move forward without being controlled by self. So, think about that for a sec. Fearless is the courage to move forward. So, we're on the line, right? It's not the courage to either get in or out of the box. We're talking line, but we're also talking, we're moving in a way that we're not thinking about ourself. So, as players begin to, we once again, we get rid of the main obstacle, which is self. As we get rid of self, this fearless begins to dissipate. Now I'm playing for other people, but I'm playing to my full potential.
It's brilliant. Absolutely great stuff. This is ultimately the separator. Like, we can all learn the X's and O's, but this is the stuff, the human component that obviously makes us so impactful. So I am curious then, another part of this is obviously film is so important. Analytics are so important nowadays in a sense, but how are you using those two things to help form habits and fearlessness?
I think for me, like film used to be pull you and Chris at the end of a game, and I'll show you the five things you did wrong. And I think you're going to self-correct. And that's just naturally how I'm wired, right? As I watch a game, I'm pretty self-critical. I should have done this. I should have done that. I should have done that. But once again, I don't think that changes behavior. It doesn't get to the root. And so I have to force myself to start with, man, here's what you did well. And if you do more of this, here's how you continue to help this team win. And that's a very intentional process for me because it's just not how I'm naturally wired. But I think players like to watch themselves do things well as opposed to just, hey, here's the things you did wrong. They call it the dead man's test in psychology. If a dead man can do it, it's not behavior. So a dead man cannot take bad shots. A dead man can not turn it over. So if you just tell people, stop turning it over, stop taking bad shots, you're not actually producing behavior. You need to show them, this is a good shot. You've got 2 feet in the paint. The defense didn't collapse. Let's do more of that. And then now you're producing inside of them positive behavior. That's the reinforcement we talked about. And hopefully over time, it produces the habit that we want.
We mentioned it in the All Access, taking us inside some very unique situations. So let's just share a little bit of your philosophy about going in some of these situations. Let's talk about first inside the huddle, in game, timeout. What is the philosophy for Coach Donegal?
Man, I'm always asking two questions, and I've been asking these questions for decades. Am I unifying hearts and am I creating fearless minds? And so, unifying hearts means are we tied together? Is there something that's keeping us from being unified? Is it our body language? Is it maybe it's the crowd right now? Maybe it's bad calls. And then the fearless minds is are we tied in with one thought? Are we creating for others? So, like, typically, like, you know, say I call a timeout. As they're coming back to huddle, we're walking out. I'm just going through that. Are we unified? Are we fearless? And then from there, I love to give my staff opportunities because they often have great insight. I think sometimes your players, if they're hearing one voice too much, it doesn't resonate. So it could be an offensive possession. Well, I'll look at Jeff, my assistant, and be like, man, you got something here. Or I'll even throw my GA in every once in a while. And you'll see the players like, their eyes will look up like, hey, you're throwing the GA in this? And it's almost like he's got their attention more than I do in those moments. And so we may draw something up, but I think bigger than that is you're addressing the hearts and the minds in those moments. And it could just be really quick. Hey, guys, stop focusing on the referees. Let's touch. We're going to touch right now. Or, hey, man, this is a big possession. There's one thing in our heads right now. It's to get in the paint. And then we'll drop the play. So regardless of what the play is, we better be thinking about getting in the paint because we know what happens to points per possession when we get in the paint.
It goes along with psychology, right? The first thing and the last thing you say is what they'll remember. And the stuff in the middle is that they're less likely to remember anyway. So I love that aspect of that. All your psychology is shining through. What about coaches' meetings? Because I thought that was one of the coolest things in your video series, was just this insight in terms of what happens in a coach's meeting. And I guess, first of all, do you like coaches' meetings and how do you like them structured? And then what are some things you want to get out of it?
I love our staff. We do life together. And when you love the people you work with and you trust them, it doesn't feel like a job. It feels, man, we're on mission together. I can't say I love meetings in general, but I love the idea that we try to stay aligned. And so we're during season, we're meeting every day. One, we always start by praying as a staff about our team and just because so much is relationship based. And so we're asking for just insight. What do these guys need? How can we be used in that moment? And then we begin to talk about what does practice look like for that day. I always come in with an idea right in my head. These are the drills I want to do. But then as I get insight from them, it's okay, this is how we're going to hone in. And this is what this is going to be about today. And I love that process. I love practices more than I love games. I don't know how other coaches feel, but maybe it's because you can stop, you can slow down, you really begin to see the growth. And it's less performance-based. I struggle sometimes with this. My identity's in performance. And in practice, it's not. I'm out of the box in practice. I'm not judging myself. I'm not being judged by others. So in some ways, it's like, how do we make the games like this, right? Like, how do we take the pressure off? How do we not make it performance-based? How do we put the players on the line so that we can move forward? And you've talked about this a lot. I hear this for a lot of people. Have fun. How often do we not have fun doing this? It's a long season more than any other sport. Like, we've got to keep it fun. And if you don't, man, you're going to have burnout rather quickly.
And as you said, like, a lot of that fun is taken away by the external pressures, perceived or real, all those different things that come with it. And keeping yourself in the bubble and doing those things isn't necessarily the best thing. Sometimes acknowledging those things and talking about those things is what I've learned later in my life is, no, I don't have to out tough this. I can actually acknowledge this and bring it to light and share it with others, and then it becomes less powerful. I'm curious your strategies for dealing with pressure.
No, I think it's the same way. I think, to your point, I think what you just indicated, there's an element of vulnerability that sometimes we have to lead with, right? If I walk into a room and I say, hey guys, I'm as nervous as you are right now. And it's, man, you just let the air out of the room. Because I think a lot of us with our own fears, what fear does is, we often think I'm the only one dealing with this. So you got 16 guys sitting in their lockers and they're all going, I'm the only one that's nervous right now. And then somebody says, hey, I'm just going to tell you, I'm a little nervous. It's, oh man. So it starts with vulnerability. It starts with just opening yourself up. And I think that's one of the challenges of the leadership. We think we have to be out in front and keep ourselves above everybody. But the reality is I'm in this with you guys. I've got some similar struggles, but like you, I want to grow. And I want to be in alignment as we continue to grow. And anytime I've done that, been authentic, maybe confessed some things, I feel like I'm in alignment and we're moving. And that's where you want to be as a coach. I think some of my most challenging moments this year is when we weren't aligned, right? If your best player is not fully on board, it's hard. It is really hard. And as coaches, we go home. Our mind is aware it was 2 hours ago. Why weren't I getting along with this guy? Why aren't we on the same page? Or after a game, if you lose, we've all woke up at 3 a.m. And to me, it's about, man, I'm not in alignment. I'm frustrated. And that's the hard part of coaching. So when you get in alignment, when you have these authentic relationships and conversations, now there's like harmony and peace. And you're like, this is the greatest job in the world. Like, how do I spend more time here than out of alignment and in frustration?
Another thing that was really enjoyable to watch, whether you thought so or not, we can ask, but was watching you in-game coach. And so many things came back to me watching that. Just this experience of coaching in games. And again, we like to say we're consciously aware, but so much of it is unconscious and this process of coaching. So maybe first frame it for us. What are some of the goals for you in-game coaching and particularly balancing coaching versus not coaching? Because some of the most powerful things that you did, it seemed like, was not coaching.
Yeah, I'm glad you mic'd me up in year 20 and not year 5.
That would be the same for me, coach.
Some of the stuff I might have said, I can't imagine. And honestly, I just forgot the mic was on me. That's good. I think I've got a focus to me that I just forgot. And going back and listening and watching to it, I was just laughing. And I want to say this. I think sometimes coaching in games is overrated, right? And part of it, I'm not like an excellent X and O's guy. I don't mark myself as that. I tend to look at things as more like you do your work in practice, you prepare your guys, and now it's on them. Now, don't get me wrong, there's adjustments to be made and whatnot. But once again, I try not to over coach. I try to lead more than I am coaching. And so sometimes the best way you can get through to somebody is just to tell them I believe in them. Let's say you start out the game 0-3. I'm not sure it does me any good to talk about your elbow and, hey, get the ball up and just say, hey, Chris, I believe in you, man. You were in the gym last night. I see you in the gym. You've shot 5,000 shots in the last week. To me, that may set you free and get you on a path quicker than trying to overcoach you in that moment. And so I try to do more of that in a game than all the other things.
That shines through for sure. And inevitably, the other part that goes with that is like preparing your players. who are going to go into the game and preparing them with certain cues or certain triggers that are going to happen. So talk to us about that, because again, that was represented.
Yeah, once again, I go back to this whole idea of habits. Like, players don't default to what they know. So whatever you said, unless they've repeated that over and over and it's a habit, don't expect them to do it. And so whatever you're doing that week in practice is so crucial for the game. And I don't think you can just put it in on Friday and then expect them to execute it on Saturday. It's, once again, we started walling in September and we're learning for it to become our habit in February. Dusty May had that famous line this year about April habits. So they put a sign up in their locker room at the beginning of the year that said April habits. And what he was saying to the guys was, every day we walk in here, we're thinking about April and our habits have to be ingrained by that time. And so I think that's a lot of what we're doing in practice. And this probably goes back to that, the whole concept of fearless too. As I've gotten older, we spend less time preparing for our opponents and more time on ourselves. It used to be, if you ran 10 ball screen sets, we'd spend 2 days executing against all those ball screen sets. What I found out was teams often switch things up, or if it doesn't go well as planned, we've just spent all that time preparing for something that doesn't happen or is not going well, as opposed to like, how do we prepare, one, who we are, but then two, just like random chaoticness of ball screen defense. To me, that's more game-like. That's more preparing our guys for that moment. And so we have changed the way we practice and the way we prepare going into games like that.
Coach, let's go a little bit deeper as we start to wind down and take this into specific habits, specific things relative. Let's choose defense as a side of the ball. So we give some coaches some of the techniques, some of the tactics, some of the understanding of how all this connects together.
So I think we mentioned earlier about the idea of we measure a lot of things in basketball. We measure points per possession, we measure shooting percentages, but is there a way to measure habits? And I think one of the things we did this year was realize if we're not measuring something, we're not getting more of it. And one of the areas on defense we wanted to become better at is what we call stick hands. The University of Houston do this a lot. And on every catch, they're affecting the offensive player's catch, or just, we call it shocking the nervous system. Like, they feel it, they react to it. But man, it wasn't a habit of our guys because they didn't do it all summer long in open gym. So we were getting like a stick hand on every 10 catches. And we're like, this is not who we want to become. And we didn't have a baseline for like how many, because sometimes a guy catches it out the volleyball line and we're playing a packed defense. But anyways, we started to measure. Here's the rate at which we want a stick hand. And we started showing our guys. And over time, what we started to see was the more stick hands we got, the better we were becoming in every area. And so by the end of the year, it became a pretty natural thing for us to stick hand. One of the other things we were looking at was hit first. How often do we hit first as opposed to being hit? And man, you'd be surprised. This was like this, up and down. And if I had a box mentality, I would have been really frustrated and quit on the guys. But it was like, okay, let's put them on the line. Let's be honest. Because there's two things about the line. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but one, just be honest where you're at. And two, be willing to move forward. So the honesty was, look, we're not good at this right now. You guys aren't doing this. Two, are you willing to move forward? Can we move in the direction and get better over time? And you know, that's what started to happen with the hit first. We became a more physical team. We started to initiate contact. And through the course of the year, we got much better at that.
How about on offense? What are some things similarly?
This year, we spent time talking about reversals and paint touches. Those things highly correlate. And so, trying to build in habits of how we reverse the ball and how we get into the paint. And the numbers, it was so predictable, but yet it was like almost mind-boggling of why sometimes we wouldn't do it more. Because we'd show our guys zero reversals, you're like 0.6 points per possession. You get all the way up to two reversals and a paint touch, and you're at like 1.2, which would lead the country. And we posted this, but how often do we find ourselves in a timeout? And we'd say, guys, we're 5 minutes into the game. We have zero reversals and we're down. And there's a re and they, I know we need to reverse it. We need to get in the paint. So once again, they're defaulting, right, to whatever their habits are. But by the end of the year, it was like, it was pretty natural for us. You'd hear guys say, hey, we've got to have a reversal and we got to get in the paint on this possession. And once again, it wasn't us saying it, was the players saying it. So they owned it. It was becoming a team habit for what they were doing.
In terms of, you mentioned variable ways to reverse the ball. What are some different ways that you reverse the ball? I assume it's a little bit conceptual in terms of understanding.
I don't know if it's conceptual. It's just more, are you willing to do it? Because once again, like we had a kid, he caught it. and he just wanted to pound it top of the key and look both ways. And it was like, we need you to get rid of this ball. And we tried to say it in 10 different ways, and he would default back to it. So, you know what we ended up doing? Putting him on the bench. That was the best way we could get reversals because he wouldn't do it. And so we
Still
had
the
another
best
guy.
teacher, right?
It is. Bob Knight said it in a little more colorful way, but we just had to do that. We had another guy who wasn't as talented. All he did is move the ball, and he understood that. And the numbers don't lie. So the conversation was this. We pulled this kid in. I'll call him Billy. He said, Billy, man, we're trying to play you at the four. Let me show you when you're in the game, what synergy tells me is our points per possession. And it was awful. It's like, and I showed him in the league, we are last in the league when you're in the game. Now, when you're out of the game, let me show you. And it was 1.1. We are number one in the league. Now, what do you think I should do? As much as he didn't want to admit it, he's like, man, you probably shouldn't play me. I said, that's what we're going to do. And then he bought in a little bit after that. What I always say, like, the numbers don't care about your feelings, right? I'm just giving you these numbers. You can either accept them and change, or you can fight the numbers and you can watch from the bench. And ultimately, I think he ended up watching from the bench a lot.
When you are in that situation, the player goes to the bench, and rightly so in that situation, what are some ways for them to get off the bench? Because I think that's the big challenge of that.
Number one, I think where you sit matters. And we always leave a space open next to our assistant coach. One of the things that bothers me the most is when, you know, I understand in the moment you come out and you're upset. Like that's an emotion, you're a competitor. But when you go down and you touch everybody, what you do next signals a lot to me. Do you go down the end of the bench and you pout? I'm not fighting you in that moment. Do you sit next to us, allow us to just put our arm around you, redirect your focus? Then you got a chance to go back in the game. And so we're always leaving that seat open and we're gauging that person. And I think you got to know who you're talking to. We had a kid that you could pull out, you couldn't talk to him for 3 minutes, and that was fine. We learned that over time. But after 3 minutes, then we had to have a conversation. Some of your players, you can talk to them right away and they want feedback right away. Hey, coach, what's going on? Tell me what I need to know. And it's, hey, I'll tell you right away. So you learn these things once again through relationships. And there used to be this adage in coaching, treat everybody the same. You can't treat everybody the same. Everybody's got a unique personality. Everybody learns differently. You have 16 different learners. So you better have different teaching styles to go along with that. The expectations are the same. How we get there is going to be quite different.
Coach, as we wrap up, you mentioned habits and studying that and diving into that. But what are some other things on your mind this summer that you're looking at that maybe coaches should consider too?
I think we're all navigating the new world of college basketball right now. You can sit there and complain about it, and I don't love where it's at with transfers, with NIL. I think we've doubled down and just said, this is who we are. Where I am third is at the heart of what we want to become and who we are. And not everybody's going to choose that, and some guys are going to leave early. And as frustrating as that is, you know, you can complain about it, or you can just say, this is who we are, and this is the impact we're making. And once again, I'm not going to define myself by an identity-based performance. Coaching's too short. I'm in the fourth quarter. I've been coaching for 21 years. I don't know how much longer, but I know I'm not in the first half. And I don't want to look back and say, man, all that worry about my record, all that worry about my identity was not worth it. We're impacting players' lives, and eternity is at stake here. And the opportunity we have, you just can't beat it. There's no other job I would rather do. I don't care what it would pay me. This is fulfilling. This is incredibly rich. Yeah, it's tough. And we're going through a period right now, but all the more opportunity to just surrender and continue to let God work through this program.
Love that. So well said, coach. We super appreciate it and super appreciate you sharing with us both in the podcast and the All Access videos as well. And just a wonderful service to coaches around the world. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Chris. Always fun talking hoops with you.